Commander Eppard, Rail 6. You were telling a story of when you were in dry dock at Govan and your treatment of some sleeping dock workers, if you continue.
The dockyard mates were asleep in the compartment late at night, not in our view having done any work during the day. We were quite keen to get back to sea. And the petty officer concerned decided that there could be nobody in the compartment that late at night, so we locked the door. The next day we found we'd caused the whole dockyard to go out on strike, and there was no work being done, until I had to be held up as the silly little midshipman who didn't understand the way in which dockyard mates worked. This was my first introduction of the very narrow distinction between the trades and the trades disputes which could rise. The particular thing in this compartment, which was very low down, was the problem of running electric wires from one side of the compartment to another and through the bulkheads. The electricians could deal with the wires, but it took a shipwright to bore the holes and a corker or somebody to make the holes watertight. And for whatever reason, it was very difficult to persuade all three trades to appear at the right time in the right place. There was even an argument about the size of the wires and therefore the sort of overhead metalwork on which they could, along which they could be run. Anything above a certain weight had to be of metal. Anything below that weight could be of wood. And there was an argument between the metal workers and the wood workers as to exactly which was which. Anyway, I was dressed down very firmly by everybody, but given to feel that just maybe my zeal to get the ship back to sea was fully understood by the sea officers on board anyway. The lesson learnt there stood me in very good stead when I was standing by HMS Belfast many years later.
We'll come to that.
Yes.
Now, how long were you in dry dock?
About a week. My recollection of the details of dates and times are not clear. But we went out to the Mediterranean again after that, and I think did a couple more convoys. But we were back in Scarpa Flow by the time I left the ship in the late autumn of 1941. Because I was due to go and do subtenant courses.
Now, before that, we should have the Bismarck affair.
We should indeed. That's perhaps why I was doing these things. You're absolutely right.
Now, the thing, in your notes...
That was from coming up from the south, from Gibraltar, towards that. Yes, I can do that bit.
Okay. And there's also something about battle with French forces. I'm not sure whether...
Yes, there was that. Yes, I'll put those two in.
Right. If we go on to those, then.
At one time, Sheffield was at Gibraltar, and we'd received a cipher during the night, though I didn't know it at the time, ordering us to go to sea and intercept a French convoy coming in from the Atlantic, which was escorted by a French light cruiser called Montcalm, and to stop them, since they were bringing wolfram, which was en route to the Germans. Unfortunately, the instructor lieutenant who had deciphered the signal and rushed it along to the captain in the morning watch had not made certain that the captain had fully woken up. So he went to sleep again with the cipher under his pillow without actually ordering the ship to go to sea. There was a very worried signal from Flag Officer Gibraltar saying, why the hell aren't you at sea, in effect, not long afterwards. So we went to sea in a great hurry with the 8th Destroyer Flotilla, Forrester, Forsyte, all the rest of them. By then, the Frenchmen were through the Straits of Gibraltar and on their way down towards Merseyrquivir. We went flat out, and we caught them about 10 miles or so short of Merzel-Kebir. And Montcalm hove to and kept her guns trained fore and aft, very wisely, because we were pointing our 6-inch guns at her from comparatively close range. And perhaps less wisely, made a signal over their shoulder to the merchant ships to disperse and run for it under the guns of Merzel-Kebir. We sent the destroyers, our destroyers, in after them, and the destroyers came under fire from the guns ashore. Obviously quite powerful coastal batteries protecting Merzel-Kebir. So Sheffield took on the coastal batteries while keeping a pretty close eye on Montcalm, and also stayed with their guns trained fore and aft. When it was apparent that we weren't going to be able to stop these merchant ships, the destroyers were recalled, and we went back to Gibraltar, feeling rather stupid. Just before we got to Gibraltar, we were attacked by French aircraft, in fact, American-built aircraft in French colors, which had been supplied to the French by the Americans to fight the Germans. But they attacked us short of Gibraltar and pressed home their attacks with considerable courage. I was very conscious that these shallow dive bombing aircraft had been at peace long enough to polish the noses of their bombs, because I, in my very powerful binoculars, indicating where the enemy aircraft were to our 4-inch guns and the director, I could see the little propeller on the front end of the bomb going gradually round, arming it, and the rest of the nose of the bomb highly polished. And at least one of these so caught my attention, I failed to go on pointing at the aeroplane and became totally hooked on this bomb getting bigger and bigger in my large glasses. And it went into the sea about 20 or 30 feet off the port bow and disappeared from my sight as it went under the level of the forecastle before it blew up. And I got a very wet shirt indeed, and we had some rivets blown into a storeroom forward. Some of the destroyers were hit, and there were some casualties. And eventually the aircraft pushed off. But they had been firing their machine guns at us as well as that. They really meant it. As we turned around Europa Point to go into the bay, we had a signal from Flagos Gibraltar, which said, in effect, there's another raid coming in. Our radar on top of the rock can pick it up, even if yours can't. And you're to go to sea and go up and down off Europa Point until all the mess you've stirred up has been settled. So we duly went to sea and cruised backwards and forwards until the next raid came in, which was equally well pressed home by the French. I think probably that ended my captain's career, because he did leave the ship, although not immediately. He was succeeded by another officer, and I never heard anything about him again.
Do you remember his name?
Charles Larkham. L-O-M-B-E, I think. But he didn't go until after the Bismarck incident.
While we're on it, what was your opinion of Charles Larkham?
There were so many levels between me and him that I really knew very little about him, except that he regarded midshipmen as pond life. If in really filthy weather, with rain or hail or snow or something blowing across the forecastle, he wanted to send the message down to the first lieutenant, who was in charge of the forecastle operations of entering and leaving harbour, he would turn round and say, "Messenger, no, messenger, you stay here. Snotty, go down to the forecastle." And I felt no particular affection for him. Not because he'd had me under arrest virtually a couple of times in Scarpa for the earlier instance I'd described, but that he wasn't a warm man. Unfortunately, I had also had reason to laugh at him. when he'd been sent for by the Admiral commanding Force H. I was driving his motorboat, and I took him across with enormous panache when he was sitting in his white things with his sword and medals and all the rest of it on the beautifully ornate seat of the motorboat. And I managed to bring the boat alongside with tremendous panache and went full astern and popped up to salute as we were sitting there, rocking slightly, and there was no sign of the captain. And then he had fallen with my full astern. He'd fallen off his perch and gone down into the bowels of the engine room somewhere of the boat. The Admiral was waiting at the top of the brow, looking down at him, and couldn't conceal his laughter. I was under stoppage of leave for unseamanlike behavior again or something. But I was invited by Admiral Somerville with some other midshipmen to go over and have a drink with him, which was a very generous thing for a great man to do. And while I was having a drink with him, he said, you were the midshipman in charge of that boat and brought your captain over the other day. So I said, yes, I've been under stoppage of leave ever since. And he hooted with laughter. He said, it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. So he was a very human chap. And one felt sorry for him that in listening to the radar, the fighter radio frequencies, which he did, he'd heard his son being killed as a fighter pilot on one of the Fulmers. Jumping to the Bismarck affair, we were in Gibraltar with the Whale of Force H, and we were told to sail with the utmost dispatch. And we tore out complete with destroyers, renowned Ark Royal, and there was one heck of a gale blowing from the west. And as we made our way northwest, we were told that Bismarck was out, and while we were there, we heard that Hood had been blown up. We didn't know what had happened to Norfolk and Admiral Wake Walker's team, but the original sub-lieutenant of the gunroom, who had been so beastly to me as a young man, was Admiral Wake Walker's son. So we knew of him. It was so rough that the destroyers couldn't keep up in the seaway. So we took the unprecedented step in wartime, with submarines about occasionally, of going on without any escorts, and was just as hard as we could. And we flew off the search from Ark Royal of the Swordfish, and we heard that Bismarck had been sighted by Catalina, and in fact the Swordfish found her about 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later. So we then knew where she was. And we also knew that there wasn't much chance of getting anywhere near her unless we could slow her down, with the exception that Sheffield was told to shadow her. If we could get within sight, we could actually see her. So at very high speed, 32 knots, very fast anyway, and going down sea, so very difficult to steer as well with these huge swells under the stern. And from where I was, forward of the funnels, occasionally enveloped in the funnel smoke, which of course was overtaking us, and horrid breathing in funnel smoke, we thought from the approximate position given by the aircraft that we had a chance of getting somewhere near her. And the chief airman eventually saw her in daylight. And so we were able to make the enemy report and fix the position beyond any shadow of doubt. We were then aware that Ark Royal was going to attack her, and we saw the aircraft, the Swordfish aircraft, coming. And we were appalled to see them tumbling out of the air like falling leaves, as they did when they made their torpedo attacks, at us. And I watched the torpedoes go into the sea, only about 300, 400 yards away, mostly on the starboard side, and from slightly ahead and slightly astern. And there seemed to be absolutely no way that we could avoid being hit by these torpedoes which had been dropped so close. The squadron CO flew across our bows at an extraordinarily low relative speed, because they were not very fast, these things, about 120 knots at most, flat out, I think. The wind was doing about 60 knots. And our only communication with these swordfish was by Aldis lamp. And the observer in the Squadron CO's aircraft flashed to us, "Sorry for the kipper," as he went across our bows. And I thought the captain was going to have an epileptic fit. However, by then, two of the torpedoes had blown up short of us. And again, I got a wet shirt from these things blowing up. And the ship bucked about a bit, but we were undamaged. So the captain was able to make a signal to the Ark Royal, suggesting that the modern magnetic pistols with which these torpedoes were fitted were useless in the weather conditions prevailing, and recommending that contact pistols should be fitted. I believe that the technical reason for this was that the magnetic pistols, which can deliver much greater damage by when they're set to run deep underneath a ship, get used to the idea of the Earth's magnetic field when they're approaching the ship. They then get the additional signature, magnetic signature, from the ship itself. And as soon as that extra magnetic signature reduces, they blow up, because at that time they should be pretty well underneath the middle of the ship. In practice, they were set to run at whatever depth it was below the surface, 40 feet, 60 feet, something like that. But the huge swells were moving them in the Earth's magnetic field as well, up and down. And the combination of the movement in the swell and the effect of the ship's signature was that they blew up short. A little while later, the Swordfish Squadron flew out again at wave top height with every instruction to contact us before they went on to Bismarck. And we had the only form of aircraft direction I've ever seen used in that way of pointing at Bismarck to show them the direction to go, and have the pilot wave back when he knew which way to go. And because I had these huge binoculars, I was able to see the attack on Bismarck through the spume and the bit of smoke from Bismarck as well. And I could see this tumbling attack going on, and then the huge spout of water, whitish through the mist, showing aft, and a bit of red in the middle of it, right down aft. So I was frightfully excited and talked about hits and so on. And, of course, there was no relative speed between these two ships at that time. We were shadowing her and both going towards Brest at whatever speed it was, 30-odd knots. Because of the smoke and all the rest of it, we didn't detect the fact that Bismarck was turning until what had been a zero closing rate became a 60-knot closing rate, because her rudder was jammed over and she turned to port towards us. And we suddenly found ourselves getting altogether too close. We had been shadowing at round about 20,000 yards range. And we had brought it down to 15,000 or 12,000 inadvertently, in no time flat. And she then fired a broadside at us, and we turned, and as we began to turn, the first broadside came down, and they straddled us with the first broadside. In those circumstances, we were jolly lucky to be missed by the second one. But the shells, the big shell she was firing, went off as soon as they hit the sea. Apparently, she thought we were a destroyer, and therefore would be more damaged by contact pistols rather than by delayed action pistols within the shells. In the circumstances, therefore, a very large piece of one of their shells hit the stand behind which I was standing with the binoculars on the top and fell into a puddle at my feet and produced a cloud of steam around my feet. And one of the lookouts, who was a baronet, I think, ripped off his headphones and ran for it. Well, there's nowhere to run under those conditions. And so I hit him very hard indeed as he went by, because I knew about panic being infectious and so on, and knocked him out. So he fell into the puddle at my feet while we got on with the war at our end and tried to turn and make smoke and all the rest of it. All the signal halyards were cut, and most of the electric wires up the foremost were cut. So it was spectacular business of signal halyards flapping in the breeze and electric sparks running up and down the mainmast, foremost rather. And I think we were very lucky to get away with it, because she only fired two broadsides.
And you weren't, there were no direct hits?
No direct hits. There were some casualties down aft where the splinters came in. But there was a piece of shell as big as my hand, which was in the puddle at my feet. And didn't do my sight any good either that I was standing behind.
Did you realise how important the torpedo hit had been at the time?
No, not immediately. It became apparent during the next few hours that the home fleet, which had been trying to catch up from the Northern, was now actually entering the scene. And as we were turning away, wondering whether we were going on shadowing or what we were going to do next, four of the tribals appeared out of the spume to go and continue shadowing. What I now know, because I've had a letter from the schoolmaster who was down in the plot talking to the captain, was that he and one other officer were trying to persuade the captain that the right thing to do with a damaged battleship within reach was for the cruiser to go in and fire torpedoes at it. The captain was in no condition, and I wouldn't wish to record why, to do anything about that. And so we didn't go in to do any torpedoes, and I think it's probably just as well if they were that accurate with their first broadside under those conditions. So we rejoined the Ark Royal and Force H. And the next day, our job was to act as crash boat for the Ark Royal, because the destroyers still hadn't caught up from the south. And the
crash boat
meaning available to pick up any aircraft that went into the sea while trying to do some deck landing. So we were about two cables fine on the starboard quarter, because the aircraft came in over the port quarter in order to land.
Did you actually have to pick anyone up?
No, nobody went into the sea landing, but the Ark wished to be into the final death throes of Bismarck and flew off another torpedo attack. At that time, the sea was so rough that the difficulty was to slow the Ark down sufficiently to enable the aircraft to land on again afterwards, because the speed over the deck, wind speed over the deck, was so high. And when she put her nose down into these huge swells, you could see the sea breaking over the flight deck, which is about the only time I've seen green water sloshing down the flight deck of a carrier. So when they came back with their torpedoes, because Bismarck business was over by then, the squadron CO was the first one to have a go at landing. And he couldn't make his aeroplane stall and land on the deck. So, because the Ark was unsteerable at less than 6 knots, and there was something like 50 knots of wind coming over the bows, and at that speed you couldn't fly the thing down. However, in the end, he cut the engine and slid. The batsman gave the signal of crossed hands for this engine to be cut. The batsman then dived into his funnel and got out of the way. The aircraft hit the deck with one heck of a clunk, and immediately the Ark Royal rolled to port, and the aircraft slithered down the wet deck and went into the netting on the port side. So the rest of the aircraft were told to throw their torpedoes away and not to arrive with a live torpedo, please, in that form. And indeed, they all got back on board, though some of them were bent in the course of getting back.
Your ship didn't see the end of the Bismarck.
No, we were over the horizon. Over the horizon by then. A great friend of mine in Dorsetshire, which I think delivered the torpedo, which was the coup de grace for the Bismarck, called Joe Brooks, was involved in picking up the survivors from Bismarck. And he went into the sea because these oil-covered survivors were having difficulty getting themselves on to ropes and things. He went in the sea to help them, and indeed did help them, and was charged by his captain with cowardice in the face of desertion in the face of the enemy. As a result, he felt that his naval career was over, and he volunteered for midget submarines. And he would have been on the run, which dealt with Tirpitz, but the boat he was going to join and make the attack in was last going across the North Sea. He is a very firm character, and there was a great deal about him in the newspapers when he died, because working for me, he subsequently blew his legs off, or one leg off, both legs off, and he later sailed as the navigator of Scepter in the America's Cup.
Well, I know it's another story altogether. And what happened next after you know the Bismarck was sunk?
Well, eventually Sheffield, having refilled Gibraltar, went back to Gibraltar with Force H and picked up the somewhat storm-damaged destroyers which had been labouring up through the Bay of Biscay. We all were at Gibraltar for a little while. How long, I don't know. And Sheffield was redeployed back to Scapa Flow, the home fleet. By October-November 1941, we were in Scapa, and we were, the midshipmen who joined 18 months beforehand were due to do their examinations for sub-lieutenant. And we were going to do them in the ship, but based on the ship and sent across to Repulse, I think it was, another battle cruiser. And quite suddenly, Sheffield was ordered to sea with the utmost dispatch. There was some sort of panic, and I'm not certain what it was. And we were told to get out of the ship in 2 hours' notice, and frantically trying to throw everything into our cases and get things up from the midshipman's chest flap and so on. We were still struggling with it when the ship was underway across the flow, going towards the Hoxha Gate. And a fishing drifter had been brought alongside for us, but the ladder to the fishing drifter had been hauled up. So I had to jump for it, which was about 10 feet, having thrown my gear down into the fishing drifter. And I wrecked my ankle quite badly getting into the fishing drifter. And we went to Repulse. Now, exactly what happened to Sheffield that night, I'm not sure, but I was told that she had been damaged under the compartment where I was sleeping, and that there had been many casualties there, which was down aft as I was working for my exams. I no longer slept up forward. I never found out the rights and wrongs of that story, but I did my exams on board. Perhaps I can't put my, which I came across.